I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. For the rest of the show, we've got Gary Staub in the studio. I first became intrigued by Gary through his Facebook page, where he hosts a weekly game called What Is It Wednesday? Every Wednesday, he posts an extreme close-up image of something he happens to have lying around, and lots of people guess what it is. But the answer is always something like, oh, that's an ostrich pelvis, or hey, that's got to be the horn of a doll sheep, or I think that's a gar. In case you don't know what a gar is, it's a primitive fish. So who is this guy, and why does he have an ostrich pelvis and a primitive fish in his Kearney, Missouri workspace? Let's find out. I'm pleased to welcome Gary Staub to the show. Good morning, Gary.
Thanks for having me.
In a nutshell, what is your deal? What do you do?
I'm a paleo artist, so my specialty is to create models for natural history museums. So I make models of everything from tiny insects to life-size dinosaurs.
Or even the eyes of tiny insects.
if it needs to be explained in a way that the public can interpret it for museums, then that's my job.
It seems like a lot of the creatures you create are species that either don't exist anymore or don't exist as they did at the time when you need to kind of represent what they looked like in a really lifelike way. How do you do that?
Sure. So it's a lot of layers. It begins by looking at fossils, and the bones can tell a fantastic story. It's as the previous guest alluded to, sometimes the science can give us a really good snapshot of what we know from the past, but there are parts of that story that are missing. So fossils are very much the same way. So what I do is I'll look at bones, I look at fossils, and I put muscle over those bones and then the skin over those muscles and give us a view of the past. And hopefully, by studying modern animals, we can use those correlates to help flesh out prehistoric animals in a very accurate way.
Your clients are impressive. The University of Chicago, National Geographic, prominent natural history museums all over the world. I mention this because I'm curious, are you the go-to guy for this sort of thing?
There's only a handful of people who specialize in doing this as individuals. There are large firms that create themed environments and sculptures that are used in visitor centers. But as an individual who has we have a small staff. We have two people who work for us, and there's just not that many people who do it. It's true. My pat answer is you could have them all over and for dinner and not have to borrow plates from the neighbors.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects you've done. I'm interested in, forgive my pronunciation, the Sarcosuchus imperator?
Sarcosuchus imperator.
Sarcosuchus imperator. It looks like a giant alligator, and there's this great photo of you sitting on top of it, which shows just how big it really is. You look tiny perched on that thing.
So that's a 40-foot-long crocodile that was found in the deserts of the Sahara. And it was found by a paleontologist from the University of Chicago, Dr. Paul Serino. And the skull on that particular crocodilian is 6 feet long. So I was commissioned by National Geographic to create a model of what that animal looked like in life.
So when you say it was found, you mean that the bones or the fossils were found?
Exactly. They were dug out of the Sahara. Not only just one specimen, but multiple specimens of this particular species were found. And because we have crocodiles around today, there's lots of great guidelines they can give us to putting the flesh on this prehistoric crocodile. So I got to actually go out with the biologists, catch some crocodiles, take measurements of them, and then use that information to help flesh out this enormous crocodile.
You work in a lot of different materials. Like some of your sculptures or models are made out of clay, some are fiberglass, some resin. So using this example of the Sarcosuchus imperator. How do you go about realizing what are the right materials for this job? How am I going to approach it? How am I going to build this thing?
Sure. So in that case, that model had to travel. We made two full-size animals, and they had to travel worldwide. So the need for the model drives what the material choice is. So in that case, we made it out of fiberglass because it had to actually fly And the opening was in Sydney, Australia. So it actually, FedEx was one of the sponsors, and so it had to be overnighted to Sydney, Australia, and in pieces where it could be assembled on site for an opening. So whether it be bronze or glass or a silicone rubber that looks very flesh-like, it just really depends on what the client wants and what the final use is.
What portion of this comes from your own imagination? I mean, you're trying to work, I can tell, like very scientifically, but there has to be some element of it that's your imagination. And I'm interested in that because this is shaping people's ideas worldwide about what an entire species looked like.
Sure. These are very durable images. And so when an artist creates an image of an animal from the past for the first time, it becomes the prototype for that animal. And so I've had the pleasure of creating the first image of new species a number of times. And it's the image that gets used over and over and over. So yes, it comes with quite a bit of weight when you're creating these images. But a skeleton will give you a very good blueprint. And if you pay attention to the skeleton, there are hard and fast things that we know for sure. There are things like color that we don't know. And that's where the imagination part comes in. And so you look at modern animals, and that's the part that is very fun for me as well. So you have 1 foot in each field. So you're an artist and a citizen scientist. And you have to have the language to be able to make that, to communicate with scientists and create something that people will understand and enjoy as they go to a museum.
Where did you get both of these languages, the scientific language and the artistic language?
The art part came first. I did a dual major at a small college in Nebraska, Hastings College, and where I was able to study art and biology. And so I sort of learned them simultaneously, but I learned it's a steeper learning curve for the science part of it. And because I work in so many different fields, from archaeology to paleontology to biology, there's a lot more jargon that I have to learn. And so that is actually one of the toughest bits, is to try and keep on top of all the new finds, the latest discoveries, and just kind of keep abreast of what's happening in the scientific world.
The big story in your career, as far as I can tell, is the story of Lucy. You were hired by the Houston Museum of Natural Sciences to make a model of the human ancestor known as Lucy, whose bones were discovered in Africa. That turned out to be quite a controversial project.
Anytime you work on a human ancestor or a rendition of a human ancestor, you're going to open yourself up for criticism. It's just the way it is, because there's a whole bunch of people studying a very small amount of fossils. And because of that, everyone has a very strong opinion. And so you can't be a paleo artist and be afraid of being wrong, because there's always going to be a new fossil that might be more complete found that will make your previous version maybe obsolete or incorrect. But we work with the best information that we have at the time.
Tell that story of the Lucy model.
So Lucy is about 40% complete. It's 3.2 million years old. And she is utterly fascinating. We do know some things about her anatomy that we can very certainly say. So we look at the hole on the bottom of her skull where the vertebral column goes up, and you look at the placement of that compared to chimps or other great apes, and look at that position, and that gives us a great clue as to if she was walking upright or in a more chimp-like fashion. And her pelvis is also very important in that. So we can look at those anatomical characters, which are preserved very well. And so the controversy comes in two ways. So the controversy will be, some people don't think we're related to apes at all, and that's more of the antiquity of the Earth question, and others are other comments are related to the particular flesh version or the flesh the soft tissue choices that I made in bringing her visage back. So trying to put those individual muscles on the face, on that skull, and trying to, breathe some life into it in a way that people can relate to it.
Just like emotionally and intellectually, what was that experience like? I mean, Lucy is a very famous set of bones. I mean,
so you find yourself in a position of working on this thing that, I mean, there's been so much written about Lucy, and the stack of literature that I accumulated to start my research is taller than she is. So that it's very intimidating to work on projects like that. They're sort of icons of evolution, and so to have the opportunity is because my sculpture was actually displayed right next to the real fossil when it went on tour. So that was an amazing privilege, and I constantly pinch myself that these opportunities happen to me. It's been a real treat.
Were you in any way surprised yourself by what you created when you looked at your completed Lucy?
Yeah. So when you're working on this thing, and it's very easy to get lost in the details of it, and so you know it's muscle on muscle on muscle, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning you're working on it, and you set the eyes and you put an eyelid over that, and that's because it's all part of this procedure that you've established for creating an accurate rendition. But then there's a moment where you look into the eyes of this thing, and it looks back at you. And it looks back at you in a way that you understand it as being something that's relatable.
And separate from yourself.
And separate from yourself. So that's a beautiful part of what I get to do is get to look into the past in a very detailed way.
People protested this exhibit, this traveling exhibit, and this sculpture had something to do with that. And that does relate to just people's really strong beliefs about the history of humanity and the history of life. But did that level of response surprise you?
It doesn't, because there are a lot of people who don't agree with a deep time scenario for the Earth. So that's the origin of that dispute primarily.
Central Standard is headed to a short break. We'll get right back into this conversation with the Missouri man who makes prehistoric life models, Gary Staub. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will return. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Gary Staub. He builds models of prehistoric life forms in his Kearney, Missouri studio. And those models go all over the world to museums, universities, and even film sets. You can see images of his work on our website, kcur.org. We've got a slideshow there. And Gary, we were just hearing about your model of Lucy, the human ancestor, which turned out to be a controversial part of an exhibit at the Houston Museum of Natural Sciences. But you've got a new project that's very different, Iceman. What is Iceman?
So the Iceman, his nickname is Ötzi. And Ötzi is a 5,300-year-old wet mummy. He was a man that was trapped in a glacier on the border of Austria and Italy and preserved in an amazing way. So we know so much about him because of how of the preservation. So having a natural mummy like that is incredibly rare. And so my current project is to make a replica of him that will then travel in an exhibit as well, and also be housed at the Cold Spring Harbor Genetics Laboratory. And he is an amazing story because, one, he was murdered. We know because he has an arrow in his back. We know.
Yikes!
Yeah, it's actually one of the you couldn't write a more fantastical story because
so much for the good old days.
Has been studied at to the level that we know his last two meals, because they can DNA the samples of the food in his intestine.
Whoa!
And get a sense of what he ate.
What did he eat?
Well, he had a mix of grains in his belly. So there's two different varieties of grains, and he also had a wild sheep that he ate as well, and we know that he had medicinal mushrooms with him, so kind of lichens that were used medicinally to help him get rid of parasites, which he did have and are still retained in his gut. So he had 61 tattoos.
What kind of tattoos? What did they depict?
You know, the funny thing about them is they look like a barcode, but they're done in areas on his body where he may have had chronic pain. So behind, by his knees, on his wrists and his lower back, all of these areas where you may have developed chronic pain over time. And the thought is, because we don't really know, that they were put there for treatment of that pain, sort of an ailment.
So this guy sounds like he had a lot of suffering going on, from his parasites to his chronic pain to that little run-in with a bow and arrow.
It's hard to know, but it seems actually for his age, and that he was in fairly good health, aside from, you know, the odd parasite in his gut. But he obviously made someone very angry at some point.
So what is it? I mean, when you take on a project like this and you're creating this entire story in your mind, does the story help you depict that person, or is the story a distraction? I mean, you're trying to create as close a physical likeness as you can.
Right. So if I do my job correctly in creating a replica, no one will know that I was there. So the difference between creating a piece of fine art and creating a scientific model is that a scientific model there's no hand of the maker involved. I'm doing an absolutely faithful rendition of what that artifact looks like. In fine art, we want to see the hand of the maker. That's what makes that piece of art unique. And so if I've done my job the best way I can, no one will know I was there. And so this is the same thing with the Iceman. And so we started with medical scans. So CT scans were made of him. And we did a three-dimensional print of him in Belgium. There's a company that can actually print his whole body in one pop. And then because that captures the volume very accurately, but it doesn't capture the surface detail, my job is to go in there with my studio assistants, Meg and Jeff, and we sculpt that surface over the top of that three-dimensional print, and then we make a mold of that so we can make multiple copies. So
wow.
It's a very involved process.
With something, I mean, we haven't really talked about your work for film sets. How does your work on models for film sets differ from these models that are going to, like, museums and universities?
Sure. As of late, a lot of the work that I've done is usually small-scale versions that are then 3D scanned, and then they use that scan data to animate. So it's very fun to create a clay model and then see that thing run across the screen.
Tell me about a case where that happened, a movie where some of your models were characters.
I did. I've done a number of projects for BBC and Discovery and National Geographic Channel. One was a large format film for IMAX that was for National Geographic called Sea Monsters. And I created 17 sculptures that were then scanned, used in the magazine as well as the large format movie. So it's really, really fun to see them come alive in that way.
Does there ever feel like there's an element of playing God in what you do, like this animation of especially the creatures from the past?
I think what I do, I find myself in a very privileged situation. I really realize the novelty of what I do, and I appreciate it very much, and because I learn so much with every single project. That's the great part of it, is that I'm constantly learning, and I'm hungry to learn about new things all the time. So it's the perfect fit for me. But I understand the weight of creating these images for museums, because it's the public's view of science. So you have to understand that that's a very important thing, and I do, and I try and give it the proper weight when working on those subjects.
Can you take us out with the description of one more project that you just have loved?
I was commissioned to create a replica of the mummy of King Tut, and for National Geographic and a company called Arts and Exhibitions Incorporated. And that involved going into negotiation with the Egyptian government to get the CT scans from Egypt, and then also getting to go over into the tomb of Tutankhamun and actually take photographs and measure the actual mummy.
Wow. That is quite an adventure. Well, that's it for today's show. Gary Staub of Staub Studios, it's been really fun getting to know you, and I'll keep following your What Is It Wednesdays on Facebook.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this morning's conversations or anything you've heard on Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. It's a really easy way to listen, even when your schedule gets crazy. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, tune in for a show all about garage sales, yard sales, and estate sales. Kansas City has a whole subculture that's obsessed with that stuff, and it's part of something called a thrift economy. We'll get a window into that world tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We had help today from St. Louis Public Radio and intern Andrea Tudhope. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.